I get asked an amazing array of questions, and often personal questions, and that was by no means the worst of them. Yeah, I remember actually my very first interview as an MP being asked a question to me that felt, you know, not at all related to my role. And without even thinking, I just said to the interviewer, would you have asked me that if I was a male politician? And they said, oh my goodness, actually, no, to be honest, I wouldn't have, and then moved on. And so often I'll just, if it doesn't faze me, I'll ignore it. If it does, I might question it at the time. But otherwise, I don't really let these things get to me particularly.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is in Australia this week for her second visit since taking office. The 37-year-old swept Labor into power last year, just weeks after becoming leader of her party. And then she secured government courtesy of a deal with the veteran minority party leader Winston Peters. She hardly needs any introduction to an Australian audience. She's had plenty of publicity on this side of the ditch. Most recently in an interview on Australian commercial TV at the weekend, which became controversial because of the ultra-personal questioning by the interviewer. In the modern political world, Ardern finds herself a celebrity politician, which can be a burden as well as a bonus. I spoke to the Prime Minister a few hours before she boarded her flight for Australia. Prime Minister, could you tell us what's on the top of your list for your talks with Malcolm Turnbull?
Oh, look, there'll be a range of topics which we traverse probably every time a New Zealand and Australian leader meets. But something that I'd like to expand our conversation into is the next steps really for CER, for New Zealand and Australia. We've probably achieved some of that low-hanging fruit, as it were, but probably many people wouldn't realise the large number of small and medium-sized enterprises that trade between Australia and New Zealand. In fact, 75% of New Zealand businesses that export generate income from Australia. I'm really interested in their experience, what more we can do to improve that experience, because it's really a gateway for our exporters, and likewise, I imagine, for Australian exporters.
So will that be the main thrust from your point of view, or are there other topics coming up?
Oh, look, when it comes to our relationship, there's always a number of topics. We have obviously a shared interest in making sure that we have a strong and prosperous Pacific, obviously an interest in what's happening regionally, our respective relationships with the United States and China, our collective engagement by our defence forces overseas, citizenship issues, a whole range of topics, but particularly the focus for us this time, given it's I have a large business delegation travelling with me, will be the kinds of things that we can do to improve that very unique economic relationship that we have. So exporters, small businesses, but probably around what we can do to ease some of the border issues that we have, e-invoicing, the way we treat data going forward, a lot of room for new conversation.
Of course, we have many New Zealanders who live in Australia. Do you think that Australia sometimes undervalues the contribution of New Zealanders who are living and working here?
Well, of course, I'm an external observer, so it's really hard for me to get a day-to-day idea of the perception around the New Zealand population in Australia. But I certainly, you know, take up the opportunity to highlight as often as I can that, you know, Kiwis really are what you could call lifters. You know, they, on average, the New Zealand-born population in Australia, their workforce participation rate is 10% higher than the national average. On average, they earn more, so contributing more to that all-important tax base. So there's a good argument for saying, look, actually, beyond just the idea that we've always had reciprocal arrangements between Australian and New Zealand citizens in each country, there's good reason to really encourage the participation of that New Zealand-born population, because they contribute.
It's fair to say that recently there's been a degree of scratchiness in the relationship between the two countries, especially over your offer to take some refugees from Manus. Will you be reiterating that offer, or do you think enough's been said?
Oh, I think there's no doubt in either government's mind they know the offer's on the table. Look, if there's anything new to discuss, I'm sure we'll discuss it. I didn't perceive it too much to be. There was a lot of interest in it, which probably made it heightened. And I know that we obviously don't face the same border issues that Australia does. So that does create obviously a different domestic dynamic. But if there's new developments to discuss, we'll talk about them. Otherwise, there's a lot of other issues on the agenda as well.
There's been a couple of slaps at New Zealand, though, from our politicians over this. Have you felt they are unnecessary, given that this is a fairly generous offer?
I'm a bit more robust than to consider any of these things. Slaps, it's politics. We each have a position. We each respectively stand by it. I'm not really particularly concerned by any of the commentary around that. It was a genuine offer, and it still obviously sits on the table, but it's absolutely Australia's prerogative as to whether it's taken.
Is there any reason that you couldn't just approach the PNG government or indeed individual refugees in that country with your offer?
Yeah, there are. There's some good logistical reasons. Obviously, the basis of our offer is we wanted to make sure that they were UN-mandated refugees, both PNG and the UNHCR, working so closely with Australia in the screening and management of refugees that they're all absolutely linked. So there are good reasons why it would be important to go through Australia. And otherwise, you know, you do run the risk of creating a scenario where someone may be missed out entirely by creating dual processes. I don't think that would be a wise way to approach it.
If we could turn to the local New Zealand scene, your government has now passed your first 100 days milestone. You arrived in the job, a very new leader and someone without ministerial experience. What's been the biggest surprise you found in the nature of the job? Did you find that you had to make adjustments in either a policy sense or a work sense when you got your feet under the desk?
Yeah, I've certainly, you're right, I'd spent 9 years in opposition, obviously at a senior level, but opposition obviously still a completely different experience. I had been lucky enough for a period before I travelled overseas and worked abroad to have spent a bit of time working in Helen Clark's office. So certainly from an observational perspective, knew the rigours of the job. It's probably one of the things that meant I was so defensive about ever taking it. But when it comes to the day-to-day, it's actually been less about things like the expectations and the range of issues and the diversity of roles that you have to play and more the content. So coming in and realising, for instance, that within our justice sector, with our prison rate growing as it is now, we would have an expectation we'd need to build a new prison every few years. And that's on even with us already having one of the highest imprisonment rates relative to other Western nations. So that I knew it was bad. I didn't realise it was quite that bad. So it's more been policy discoveries that have surprised me than anything else.
One of your key commitments has been to drastically reduce child poverty within a decade. I think your target is to cut the proportion of children living in poverty from 15% to 5%. Can you explain what sort of measures you'll be looking at to achieve that target?
Yeah, so we've been using essentially measures that are used, a combination of measures used by UNICEF and the OECD, and so measures that both New Zealand and Australia are already ranked using. And those most common are the percentage of children living on, for instance, 50% and families living on 50% or less of the median income. And then measures that also look at the after housing cost incomes of families. So it is a relative measure. Our view has been that, you know, as a prosperous nation, there really is no excuse for us to have the rates of child poverty that we have. And we've looked, you know, at the countries who have, you know, essentially better outcomes for kids by ensuring they're addressing this kind of deprivation. And aimed to get our rates down as low as theirs. So often those tend to be Scandinavian countries, for instance. This isn't for us just a, you know, a morality question. It makes sense to invest in one of the biggest indicators of child wellbeing, and that is deprivation. So for us, it's a real investment to save in the longer term.
So you tackle this through family income, through education, through what, housing?
Indeed, it will be a mix. We've used a mix of measures so that we can actually target, you know, the range of things that contribute to families living in deprivation. So one is as simple as income. And we have a significant percentage of people in poverty who actually are the working poor. So things like lifting our minimum wage, but also the after housing cost measure really points to the fact that housing is just too expensive in New Zealand. And we know that to be true. So we've got plans around our own building program to try and bring more affordable housing into the market. There's also a measure that's based on a survey of really things that families go without. And it's used internationally. And if families score more than a particular number of the survey, that puts them into the category of living in deprivation. Things like skipping doctor's visits and not being able to fill prescriptions. So there are a number of things around making access to key services more accessible, or improving access, that will bring those numbers down. So it will be a range of things we'll be looking to do.
Now, in general, you've taken the big step of scrapping fees for first-year university students, and your government's pursuing initiatives, as you say, on housing and for families. How can you afford all this?
Well, simply in the same way that all governments do. They set their priorities, and we set a priority that, unlike the last government, who had put aside $1.5 billion straight off the bat for tax cuts, our view was that wasn't a good use of money. $400 million going to the top 10% wasn't the kind of investment we felt New Zealand needed at this stage. Well, investment, I use the term loosely. So we cancelled those tax cuts. Our families package, the thing that is probably going to make the biggest contribution to child poverty over our term, that cost $890 million. So already it was a more efficient way to prioritise our spending. At the same time, we've set ourselves a set of rules around fiscal responsibility, including, for instance, budgets, running budget surpluses, trying to get net core crown debt to 20% and our crown spend at relative to GDP at around 30%. So those are parameters we've set ourselves. Our tracking towards the 20% net debt, we've given ourselves a couple more years to reach that point because of our massive building program, our house building program. And that's because we simply don't think it's right to allow people to be homeless in New Zealand when we have the ability to turn that around. So that means our debt track is slightly longer.
Now, one initiative that's particularly interesting is that you plan to cast your budgets in what's called a living standards framework. You want New Zealand to be the first country to assess bids for budget spending against not just the impact on GDP, but on the country's, and I quote, natural, social, human, and possibly cultural capital. What's been the response of economists and the business community to this plan? And is there a danger that such an approach could compromise keeping a strong eye on the economic imperatives?
No. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, as you have heard me describe from those rules that we've set ourselves, balancing the books is incredibly important to us. We can't achieve what we want to achieve around social well-being without a thriving economy. And so that's why we've set those measures and the way in which a mechanism in which the public can hold us to account on that. But our view is that continuing down a track with budgets in particular, where with a singular focus on what contributes to GDP, without, for instance, looking at whether or not that contribution to GDP leads to environmental erosions, for instance, or negative social impacts, that to us felt like a crude way of measuring success for a country, and indeed actually an economy. This is something that, of course, the OECD and the IMF have been talking about for some time, and that's why our Treasury actually had started doing some work on it a while ago. We were the ones, however, that said, actually, we want to make it a reality. So we've given ourselves till next year to establish a framework, and 2019 will be the first time we give it a bit of a run. I've no doubt there'll be teething issues with it, but I think if you've got your eye on both a robust economic plan, measures that show you're keeping the books in good shape, but that you're willing to go look at success more broadly, I think that's probably a winning formula.
How are you progressing with your plans to change the rules for foreigners buying residential property in New Zealand? Have you been convinced at all by any of the lobby groups who are arguing against this?
No, I haven't. In fact, I still find it unusual, not that New Zealand is taking these steps, but that New Zealand hasn't done before. It will make us no different to Australia in that regard. Particularly when you have now the average house price in Auckland, our biggest city, at over $1 million New Zealand dollars. We just couldn't stand by and continue to allow that kind of what has been essentially a complete collapse now in the way that our housing market is operating. It is simply out of control. Now, this isn't the only thing we need to do, and I utterly accept that. We've also have a bright line test for where you'll be if you own a second home. You'll be taxed if you flick off that home within 5 years for simply purely for the capital gain. We're trying to close other tax loopholes. We've got a massive building program. So we know it's not one thing we need to do, but that is certainly part of it.
Tell us something of your plans on climate change policy. You've got a commitment for New Zealand to be zero carbon by 2050, with the interim step of making the electricity system 100% renewables by 2035, and plans to include agriculture, which is a big contributor, obviously, to your country's emissions, in your emissions trading scheme. How challenging will these goals be?
Oh, certainly. We've been ambitious. Our view is as a member of the Pacific, where our Pacific neighbours, and indeed actually New Zealand itself, will suffer from the effects of climate change. We have a duty, even though we contribute obviously less than 1% the overall global emissions profile. But actually, if every country that contributed less than 1% did nothing, that actually makes up roughly 25% of the global profile. So everything we do matters. The fact that we have already 85% of New Zealand's electricity is generated from renewable sources means that a 100% goal is absolutely achievable. But it isn't the biggest issue we have in our emissions profile. You're right that it's agriculture. We're pretty unique in that regard. The likes of Ireland is probably as close to, it gets has a similar profile, but that does make it challenging. What we want to do, therefore, is be world leaders in the kinds of technology and advancements we make in the way that we produce food. And we do think that adds really to our brand. We have a brand as Clean Green New Zealand. Now we need to expand it to being clean, green and carbon neutral. Part of that will also be our tree planting ambitions. We have ambitions over 10 years to plant a billion trees in New Zealand, acting both as carbon sinks but as a generator of regional economic development. So it'll be a mix of pine and natives for us, using some of our conservation land, marginal conservation land, for instance, encouraging private landowners to plant. There's a number of initiatives that we think overall will contribute to us reaching a goal of carbon neutral by 2050.
I'm sure ahead of your trip you've been watching some of the antics of Australian politics recently. I wonder whether you have any idea on the question of why New Zealand politics seems, at least from a distance, a good deal less hyper than our Australian politics. Is it because you're a smaller community, or you're by nature more polite, or are there any other reasons?
Yeah, I've often reflected on the difference. There certainly is a difference. Not to say New Zealand politics is still you know, very robust. We're not
beyond
all
robust here.
I have observed and thought, gosh, there's another level there in Australia. It's a particularly tough environment from what I've observed, and that's from a starting point of politics being tough enough as it is. I'm not sure I could answer what drives that, but I noticed that that the media environment feels as tough. So I wonder whether or not there's an escalation or brinksmanship that seems to happen. Either way, I actually count myself lucky. It's robust here, but it's bearable.
You think maybe it wouldn't be bearable in Australia if you were operating?
I'd struggle, yeah. Even watching the experience of Julia Gillard, putting all politics around that aside, just at a human level, that seemed a pretty tough environment to exist in.
We've had a bit of talk, of course, about our federal coalition, as you know. How much of a challenge is managing your relationship with your coalition partner, New Zealand First, and what are the mechanics on a day-to-day basis of how you do that?
Mm. Of course, the complexity for us is we have a coalition arrangement with New Zealand First and confidence and supply agreement with the Greens. We can't pass anything without both of them. So there's no doubt that is complex, but actually that's the form of government that I've grown up under. I voted under nothing else other than MMP government. So we are probably one of the more pure MMP governments in the sense that we require that our majority relies on all three partners. It means we operate differently. We're hugely consultative. The fact we don't have to worry about factions within our own parties helps. It narrows down the number of consultations having to be managed at any given time. But it is complex. But it all comes down to relationships. And those relationships often play out in a public environment. That does make it tough. And I really understand when I see other governments managing that. But we have good working relationships. We understand each other's differences, what each other's priorities are. We try and focus on the areas where we have consensus, and so far it's working well.
Just going back to recent Australian events, were you at all tempted to follow Malcolm Turnbull's example of a ban on sexual relationships between ministers and their staffs?
I have an expectation around the code, really, that our ministers operate under. And so it felt to me like a given that we would have a standard that we would expect ministers and which ministers to act. So I didn't feel that was necessary, but that's not me passing judgment on anyone else's choice on how they managed their particular situation, because it could be entirely different to ours right now. So you're always meeting the demands that are on you as a leader at that given time. And so it was, certainly I watched, and it was a really difficult situation in Australia that's been going on over this last period.
The media environment obviously makes things very testing for politicians wherever they are. And I noticed that a New Zealand commentator has written that your positioning as Prime Minister is sometimes undermined by, as they wrote, a media fascination which borders on being fatuous. Do you see long-term risks in coming in as what might be called a celebrity politician?
Well, certainly that would be other people's making, not my own.
Indeed, but
we're in a, and I find a little hard to separate out whether or not that's just the environment now for the next generation of politicians to a certain degree. There's that expectation that people have greater access to your lives. You know, it's a social media environment where people don't just have a media filter in which to access you and get to know you. And there's also a sense that people do want to know you beyond your political messaging and your ideology. So I understand that. To a certain degree, I probably am quite open and don't mind, a mixture of, having those background conversations and that background coverage about life. But there, of course, there are things you still try and preserve. My partner and I, for instance, have never done a joint magazine interview together and things like that that we've just tried to create some parameters around. But it's pretty blurry these days because I think just because of the environment we operate in. My goals, though, as a politician, remain my reason for being in this role, and nothing will ever detract from that. If I find that tipping over into a different perception of politicians into celebrities starts diminishing my ability to do the job, then I certainly would worry about that. But for now, I just see it as a part of the job.
Well, talking about the joint interviews, how did you feel after that 60 Minutes interview that focused on, to put it mildly, the ultra-personal?
Oh, well, that implies that I haven't been asked that question before, and I had. So it was put to me a little more frankly than it had been previously. So I was thrown briefly, but not offended, and I've reflected on that since. The fact that it didn't particularly stand out to me or seem noteworthy probably says I'm a bit desensitized now. I get asked an amazing array of questions and often personal questions, and that was by no means the worst of them.
And they don't worry you particularly now?
No, they don't. And, I remember actually my very first interview as an MP being asked a question to me that felt, not at all related to my role. And without even thinking, I just said to the interviewer, "Would you have asked me that if I was a male politician?" And they said, "Oh my goodness, actually, no. To be honest, I wouldn't have." And then moved on. And so often, I'll just, if it doesn't faze me, I'll ignore it. If it does, I might question it at the time. But otherwise, I don't really let these things get to me particularly.
Obviously, to an extent, the personal inevitably becomes the professional, however. And, of course, work-life balance is one of the big 21st century issues. Now, you're expecting your first child in June. Do you have a clear plan for juggling what will be needed when you have a child as you cope with what is still a very new job, or will it be a case of working out the balance as you go?
Yeah, I think I'll probably be doing what every other new parent does and working it out as I go. I consider myself lucky that we're in a position where my partner's Clark's work is flexible, so that means that he can be the primary caregiver. And we're just going to do our best. And I think probably that puts us in the category of the vast majority of parents, that you can have these best laid plans, but whether they work is an entirely different thing.
Well, it's going to be an interesting time ahead for you on all sorts of fronts. Prime Minister, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Burlage, and we'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.